Hello, and welcome to another Innovation Forum webinar with me, Ian Welsh. Today we are going to discuss smallholder farmers in Africa, and in particular, how to bridge some of the gaps between the apparently competing interests of a number of areas, including forest and ecosystem preservation, the farmers themselves, and maintaining supply security. The sustainability of agriculture in Africa has, of course, long been the subject of debate. A number of smallholder models have been proposed, but a winning formula for such an engagement remains unclear. The challenge of balancing the rights of local communities, the responsibility to protect and preserve the environment, and the need to ensure that business ventures remain economically viable continues to be a conundrum for stakeholders, as does how to help smallholders themselves develop proper sustainable business models. In this context, the question is how companies and their advisors, NGOs, local communities, and all levels of government can engage effectively to ensure sensitive development that is to the good of local communities, preserves vital ecosystems, and benefits all wider stakeholders involved. So, we have a panel of experts to help lead our discussion over the next hour. We have Mark Wong, Senior Vice President, Sustainability at Sime Darby. We have Andrew Kluth, Vice President, Sustainability at Golden Beryllium, Liberia. We have John Nelson, Mentor for Social Innovation at the Forest Trust. And Marcus Colchester, Senior Policy Advisor at the Forest People's Programme. And our apologies for a few technical problems just getting things set up today, but we're now up and running. My thanks to my Innovation Forum colleague, Leah Vavrick, for convening our panel and organising this webinar. And thank you also to Sime Darby for sponsoring. Now, the issues we'll be covering today will form part of the discussion at our Sustainable Development for Smallholders Farmers Conference, which we're holding in London next month on March 14th and 15th. The web address is on your screen, and full details are on Innovation Forum's website, where you can sign up this week for a special rate. So back to today, I will shortly invite our panelists to make some opening remarks to kick things off. We will have some follow-up discussion, and I will then open the debate up to audience questions in the second half of our hour. Now, we do want to be as interactive as possible today, so please do submit your questions using the comments box on the webinar dashboard, and I will put them to our panel. They can be to all the panel or to one of the panelists in particular, and if you can keep your questions short, it is more likely that we will use them. Please note that, as usual, for Innovation Forum webinars, there will be no slides. This is a structured panel discussion throughout. We are recording the webinar and the discussion, and we'll circulate this later on this week. And while our panel contains a lot of palm oil industry expertise, we will try to extend the discussion so it is relevant for all sectors. So there we are, and here we go. To start things off, I have asked Mark and Andrew if they will outline some of the challenges around engaging smallholders as they see them, which may or may not have established solutions. So, Mark from Sime Darby, I hope you're on the line. I see you were on the line. But I know that you're no longer there. So what I'll do is I'll turn immediately to Andrew from Golden Beryllium. Andrew, for you, what are the greatest challenges around effective engagement?
So good morning to everybody. In Liberia, the arrangement that we have under the concession agreement is that we can develop up to 220,000 hectares of land for oil palm development, and we must also develop 40,000 hectares of land for outgrowers, or what we call community oil palm. And what we're finding is that the investment climate in Liberia, the operational challenges, the political environment, and some of the engagement that we're having in community makes it very difficult for us to take the lead as a large farm operating predominantly company-led schemes. So what we've been exploring is the opportunity to be able to put much more emphasis on smallholders or community oil palm. In this manner, what we would be doing is handing the control of the farmlands themselves over to the community. We recognize in what we're doing that the farms that we operate, we don't own, we only have land use rights. And if that's the case, it makes much more sense for those to stay much more explicitly with the communities themselves. So we're working on ideas at the moment where we're developing community oil palm with independent investment going into those communities so that they can actually take the lead themselves. And we feel that from the pragmatic point of view, from the operational point of view, from the political point of view in Liberia, we stand a much greater chance of allowing development with communities in that manner than we have managed to achieve so far with our own farms. So that's where we're coming from at the moment in terms of the relationship we have with smallholders. In that regard, The other thing that we think is critical in this area is that Liberia is a very heavily forested country. And one of the challenges we have faced in the time that we've been operating here is to make sure that we're balancing the need for development against those conservation demands, which are being carried through not only with our membership of the RSPO, but also with our no deforestation commitments. And in Liberia, with the complicated landscapes we have, that is proving to be a particular challenge, working around those heavily forested areas. And with communities working on a smallholder basis, it means that there's the potential for us to work developing areas which are perhaps a little bit smaller than we would want to do if we were working just purely on our own large farms at industrial scale. So it may enable us to get a more efficient use of the available degraded land for us to be able to work with communities. But that raises other points as well, that the community structure in Liberia is quite complex. We have statutory areas such as districts, but we also have traditional clan areas which are reflecting the traditional tribal leadership, and there's also a mixing of those two areas between government appointments in certain areas and the traditional community leadership. And one of the things that we have to work through is those communities who want to be able to develop land but don't have degraded land available, and those who want to be able to get engaged in some of these programs but just can't at the moment find those opportunities. And so part of what we're trying to do is make sure that the community rights to lands are being reflected not just in those areas where they want to undertake development, but also where conservation must take a lead. And so we're developing, along with a partner, IDH, ideas where we can blend development and conservation objectives within a single integrated program. So these are the areas where we feel the greatest challenge probably exists.
Great. Thank you very much, Andrew. I wonder just very quickly if you could tell us a little bit about some of the challenges that GBL have had, obviously subject to quite a lot of activist attention, looking of the reports from Global Witness, how and others, and how have they developed or pushed you along the way of engaging with the smallholder farmer communities in particular?
Okay, that's a good fair question. When GBL first set up in Liberia, we weren't members of the RSPO. We joined shortly afterwards, but there was a complaint against GBL in the first area in which we started. And following from that complaint, we started working at the prompting of some of these NGOs with TFT, so you've got John Nelson online, to develop a set of policies and procedures and to improve the way that we engage with communities. And we've been working very hard in those areas ever since, that's from about 2012 onwards. So we believe that the arrangements we now have in place in terms of complying with the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil policies and commitments such as FPIC, the Free Prior Informed Consent, put us, we believe, in a fairly strong position in terms of how we're able to evidence now what we're doing. We don't claim that we're perfect, but we are engaged with local NGOs. We have four local NGOs as part of an NGO network we work with to try to make sure that we're responding at a local level. We have far, far better engagement with communities. We are engaged with the RSPO through regular reporting as part of the complaints process. And we are working with organizations such as IDH, as I say, where we're constantly being challenged to make sure that we're credible in order to be able to make sure that working with us is a reasonable and practical thing for them to be doing. So the NGO scrutiny, it's challenging. We don't always think that it's necessarily as well evidenced as we would like, and we've made that point in submissions to the RSPO and in response to reports from organizations such as Global Witness. But certainly when it's done well, as an independent commentary, it is extremely useful to us in giving us a different perspective on how should we examine what we're doing and how we should then improve in those areas.
Great. Well, thank you very much indeed for addressing that, Andrew. Mark from Sime Darby, I hope you're on the line. Mark, can you hear me?
I can, Ian. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Excellent, Mark. Thanks very much for being with us. So, Mark, perhaps you could answer the same initial point as Andrew and outline some of the challenges around engaging smallholders as you're seeing them at Sime Darby.
Sure. Thanks, Ian. Look, I think that because we're in the same country, both GVL and ourselves have been facing similar kind of issues. Now, if I sort of share a little bit in terms of our challenges when we first entered the country, it was really around the community engagement and the way that we did the community engagement. And I think that the first sort of pitfall we fell into was really not understanding the cultural context enough. And the reason why I say this is because if you look at Sime Darby's experience base with smallholders previously, it was very much rooted in our development of smallholder schemes in Indonesia. And so when we came across to Liberia, what we tried to do was we tried to implement the practices and the processes and approaches that we had developed in Indonesia in Liberia. And the first thing that we didn't recognize was the state in which the country was in. As a post-conflict country, the one thing we really failed to recognize was that by putting a land compensation deal on the table, we were essentially providing a really big incentive for communities and smallholders to actually give up land in exchange for currency. And the reason for that was because, you know, in their history, there weren't really a lot of opportunities for hard currency to be earned. And rather naively, the one thing we didn't recognize was that communities would actually do that at the expense of giving up land for water production or food crops. And so if you look at all the troubles that Sime Darby faced when we first entered Liberia, a lot of it was really centered around that. The fact that communities had given up land in exchange for currency, the fact that we hadn't thought through what it is that we were doing and acquiring, and it really led to a period of conflict that we had to work through where we then had to engage again with the communities, understand exactly what the issues were, come up with solutions to try and address those. Now, moving forward, one of the things that we actually tried, some of the things that we implemented to move through that was to widen out the way in which we engage with communities and also to pull together a wide range of stakeholders to provide a lot more guidance and steering as to what some of the best ways forward were for the company. Now, the reason why I say that is because a lot of the structural institutions which were also available in Indonesia were not available in Liberia to provide guidance. And so by bringing together and having people around the room, everyone from government officials, the communities themselves, civil society organizations, as well as UN agencies and other multilateral organizations, the idea was that through this forum, it was a really good channel for us to be able to put issues on the ground, to be able to test plans that we had in place, to get a broad range of views around what exactly would be the best option moving forward. Now, that does slow the process up a little bit, but what we have found is that that then at least provides us with a more robust platform to be able to plan how we actually move forward. Now, instead of the second challenge, I do want to echo what Andrew spoke about earlier on, which was that in a country like Liberia, which is heavily forested, there is a real challenge between trying to achieve the kind of community development and social development objectives that companies have with smallholder programs, together with the conservation commitments that both the government of Liberia as well as responsible companies like Sime Darby have. And the reason why I say this is because in order to put develop through into a rural area, agriculture usually is one of the first places to start. The reason being that it's investment that goes into rural areas, which is also unusual. It's the kind of industry that can be put in place in communities which do not necessarily have the level of education that the urbanites have. And thirdly, through smallholder programs, it's a way of being able to build these community-based businesses that allow for the benefits of an agricultural industry to flow through into communities directly. Now, the real challenge in a heavily forested landscape is being able to find adequate land that isn't forested, that isn't considered conservation, high conservation requirements, in order to put these farms into place. Now, there's a double-edged sword here in that, you know, even if these developments don't actually occur in these heavily forested areas, what we do find is that communities themselves will start to encroach slowly through into forested areas, where conservation areas over time will actually be degraded. And so the real challenge here is to be able to put something on the table which allows for a certain amount of clearance, but ensuring that whatever clearance happens results in benefits flowing directly through into communities, and for communities then also agreeing that in order to get this benefit, there will be a much larger area of conservation area that will be tied into the whole process.
Thank you very much indeed. Quick question. You mentioned earlier that it tends to be a kind of a period of conflict then engagement, or that's typically how it has been. How have you moved beyond that, and how are you looking to the future and going to develop projects that won't necessarily involve conflict before there's engagement?
I think the trick is to really move really slowly. So, I mean, if you look at some of the areas that we started to look into recently, I mean, we started a free, prior, and informed process 5 or 6 years ago. And the idea is to move very, very slowly to ensure that we open up very transparent channels of communication with the community itself first. But the second thing is really trying to leverage and to utilize this multi-stakeholder platform that we've created. The idea is that, you know, as we move through with development plans, ensuring that it's just a bilateral discussion between ourselves and communities, but we also bring in various different actors, such as government agencies, civil society organizations, as well as multilateral organizations in Liberia. And the reason for this is because, you know, moving forward, there's going to be input required from various different parties. So as you look at small development, the first thing is around licensing. Now, it's taken a long time, but Liberia has now started to move forward with the recognition of native customary rights in the land code. And so to a certain degree, that's where you do need government agencies to come through and provide their input and to also agree towards how it is that these community farms would be titled moving forward, which is why you need them at the table. The second thing also with smallholder development is that there is a certain amount of funding that needs to go through into community development programs, which is why you need the development agencies and the multilateral organizations. The idea being that there needs to be a certain amount of funding which can go through into these community development farms, but that needs to also be offered at a rate that smallholders will be able to pay off over time.
Thank you very much indeed, Mark. John, turning to you, TFT has, of course, worked with both Sime Darby and Golden Verulam. So from that and from your wider experience, can you give us some perspective on the good and the bad you've encountered, you know, what works and what doesn't? John.
Okay, great. So I'm going to step back a little bit when we talk about African smallholders, what we actually mean. So beyond Liberia, and part of this is like the bad, the very first step of the bad is actually the companies fail to actually understand African smallholders properly. They don't understand their practices and their history, and I think that was something that Mark picked up on in their experience. I think they learned that to their cost. And so who are these African smallholders? They're like, in some countries, 85% of the population is 500 million African smallholders, 33 million small-scale farms, and the majority, women are dominant in the smallholder sector. I don't think that's necessarily well understood by some companies. Also, there's this misconception, I think, with a lot of people or companies coming to Africa that, you know, it's all community-based and everything works for the community, and not really understanding that African smallholders are, you know, very connected to the market. The market's really important to them, very market-oriented. And they're very individualistic as well as farmers. So yes, of course, they can work together, but people are, you know, working for themselves often. And this is something to be understanding. The other thing is that they're blocked. So they're diverse, they're market-oriented, and they're blocked. They're blocked by the fact that they've got, you know, low capacities because, you know, the infrastructure in a lot of these countries, Liberia being one of the worst examples, is almost non-existent. So education, health, A lot of rent-seeking behavior, what people generally refer to as corruption, but basically rent-seeking behavior in a political economy, which where they're not really engaged politically, their rights are not recognized. They also, you know, all the barriers to reaching the market are there, transport, etc. The other thing is that they're hopeful. And I think this is, you know, African smallholders, you know, they are full of aspiration for themselves and for their children and their grandchildren. If you just look at the percentage of smallholder income spent on educating children, it dwarfs the percentage that we would spend here in Europe or elsewhere. It's, you know, so they are really investing, and because poverty is the background. So poverty is a key aspect, which companies are not talking about enough, in my view. So that's the first thing, the bad, failure to understand who you're talking about. And the other bad thing that companies do is they regard communities are just seen as a problem rather than as a partner. They're in a defensive stance. And they have this tendency to revert to this legality argument. We have the permits from the government, so we are going to develop. But there's a tension between the legal frameworks in these countries and the customary frameworks under which lands are managed in all these different places. And there's a real tension, and what companies tend to do is they go for the legal side first, and oftentimes in Liberia, for example, they might sign a contract with the government for 220,000 hectares of development land, and the government says all this land is unencumbered. Yet companies commonly go to these places and they realize actually the land is full of people, so there's a whole other set of problems there that they have to engage the communities directly. And the other aspect is this conservation aspect, where a lot of global agendas are being pressed upon communities, and communities are expected to set aside parts of their land for conservation, and sometimes the communities don't understand it because they are trying to get out of poverty, and all they have is land and forest. So that's the bad. What's the good side of what companies do and can do, which I also have seen, you know, in different places, is investing in a proper social program. The number of times I've had debates with company heads about the fact that if they would just put off buying that one extra caterpillar this year and instead put that into a properly funded social program, the investment, the payoff to that investment is really high, because they're able to engage communities properly. But the other, those engagement with those communities has to be on the basis of this, you know, this international standard, you know, free, prior, informed consent. It's about that good relation. And the key to this whole idea is the fact that these companies need to recognize community rights beyond the strict sort of national legality arguments. Companies like GVL, like Sime Darby, they have signed up to very high standards, which takes them well beyond the law in the countries where they're operating, for example, in Liberia. What they're setting out to do, you know, these are standards which are much higher than actually what it says in the national law in Liberia often. The other thing that companies can do is as part of understanding the smallholders, actually start to map out the common interest, because what I think companies need to understand is that there's a lot of shared interest between communities in these places and companies. They want companies to come in, a lot of them, because they do not have any faith that their government will ever do anything for them. In fact, in many instances, it's the government who is the main impediment to them moving forward. And I think if companies start to map out their interests, they realize there's a shared interest there. This is about partnerships, so it's a shared interest. And, of course, these other things that the companies can do is be very transparent, being really clear about what their plans are, be responsive in the engagement with communities, and, you know, building that partnership. And the key part of that with smallholders also, if you're going to engage them, you're going to have to, you know, take time, as Mark also said, you got to take time. There's a lot of capacity building that needs to be done. And at the end of the day, if you're going to be working in Africa with smallholders, you have to keep your word. You know, of 30 years of working all around Africa, doing lots of different works, almost every time I have ever actually made an agreement with African communities or whatever about what's going to happen, a handshake is enough. And as long as you stick to that and stick to, you say you're going to do something and you do it, then people believe you. But because of the way the system works there, as soon as people start, you start saying things and you don't follow through, you've just lost that relationship, as it were. So that's a bit, for me, is just stepping back away from Liberia, which I know very well, both those cases, just in a general way, thinking about the good and the bad.
Great. No, thank you very much, indeed. That's a great summary of those points. I think we'll come back to some of these points later in our hour. A lot of points I'd like to be back to Sound Derby and to Golden Barolium. But in the interest of time, I'd like to turn now to Marcus Colchester from the Forest Peoples Programme. Perhaps turn things a bit more around to the perspective of the smallholders themselves, Marcus. What do smallholder farmers want from a process of engagement?
Yeah, I think the important point hasn't been made yet, or maybe it was said when the volume was down at the beginning, was that the African oil palm is not new to the farmers in Africa. They've been cultivating it for anything up to 4,000 years. And so the problem isn't with the crop, the problem with how it's being developed and imposed in a way that's difficult for them to handle. As John said, you know, farmers are interested in engaging in the market. They want development, they want to improve their livelihoods and their welfare, and they want things like schools and clinics and roads and so on. So there should be many, you know, mutual grounds for engagement between the companies and the communities on the ground. But as we've been hearing, many, perhaps even most of the RSPO member companies developing palm oil in Africa have run into trouble in terms of their community engagement, and both Andrew and Mark were quite frank about that. But we can look at sort of the similar problems in Cameroon, Democratic Republic of Congo, and so on. The similar issues keep coming up. And that's because the way the model is being imposed doesn't really meet the community's expectations. Now, the RSPO standard actually requires that you do meet those expectations in terms of respecting the community's rights to their land and making sure they have a voice in deciding, you know, how to go ahead. That's the free, prior, and informed consent principle, that you people have a right to say yes or no to the proposal, and then that should provide room for a negotiation which makes sure that what is planned really does suit the local people. The problem is the law gets in the way and doesn't recognize these people's lands. So even when the communities are pressing for their rights, and even where the companies are agreeing to try to recognize those rights, the legal framework often doesn't allow the companies to do what they want to do, maybe. And so we've got this problem of these land conflicts. And I think it's important to recall that what's happening in Africa is really a repetition of what's been going on in Asia. So the same companies are coming over from Asia, bringing their model of development to Africa, forgetting perhaps that they've had 100 years of land conflict in Asia. And there's about 4,000 land conflicts in the palm oil sector in Indonesia at the moment, according to the National Planning Agency there. So I think we need to step back even further perhaps than John did, and start asking what is the right model that really would meet farmers' interests in development of oil palm in Africa and indeed in Asia. The fact is the Asian model is not popular because it asks the farmers to surrender their lands in exchange for a promise of development. And they're saying, well, do we have to? Can't we have options whereby we can have our secure rights on our land and lease or rent the lands to the companies, but not lose them in perpetuity, so that we have a chance of building our economies for the future, not just for this generation, but for the coming generations? And I think that's the way to get out of this present dilemma. It's not enough just to say you'll do your best within the current legal framework to meet the community's interests. We really need the governments to be brought in a more effective way to provide better legal options for the communities. And then that will allow more land to be set aside for the communities' livelihoods, more of a mosaic in the landscape, not just all over to one crop and then people are shunted aside and have to go into the forests, as we've been hearing, and particularly not reliant on a single crop, which is subject to the vagaries in the international commodity markets. So I think that's what farmers are looking for. They're looking for more flexibility and more security, so they're not pushed into a bad place when things go wrong.
Thanks, Marcus. It strikes me that, as in so many occasions, the companies really are leading the way here in terms of the legal rights or the rights for people. The fact that they go beyond so often what's required under the law is it in fact is the law itself being the problem? Is the kind of the lack of recognition of rights, is that in itself causing problems? And in fact, is the root cause, or to what extent is that the root cause, do you think, of so many of these problems?
I think it is one of the root causes is the fact that the communities don't have strong rights in the law. But then the problem is some of the bad companies, you know, take advantage of that rather than saying, well, okay, that may be the law, but we're going to treat you as landholders notwithstanding. And we're getting there with some companies, but we're not by any means out of the woods.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. And thank you very much to the audience also for your questions, which are now coming in thick and fast. I'd like to go back to Simon Darby and to Golden Verulam with a question that's come in specifically for them, and then perhaps we can get John and Marcus to comment on it. So, Mark from Simon Darby, a questioner asks, you know, given the experience and lessons you've learnt, particularly in Liberia, to what extent now do you plan to fully utilise the entire concession you have from the Liberian government, and you know, are you going to rein back and not perhaps develop all the land that you may be able, that may legally you'd be able to do so? Mark.
Hi Ian, sorry. So let me just repeat that question to see if I heard it correctly. So the question is that given the learnings we've had in Liberia, does that mean that we develop all the land that's been given to us?
That was the question. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So we have a 220,000 hectare concession in Liberia. Now, when we first landed in Liberia, there was already, I believe, an understanding in the organization that we were never going to be able to clear sell and develop the whole 220,000 hectares. The reason being that we were already fairly rooted in the principles of the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil, or RSPO, and there was already an intention to try and see how it is that we could apply those principles in that concession. So when I say that, what I mean is that on the environmental end of the spectrum, there is an intention to ensure that high conservation value forests are identified and set aside. And at the same time, there was a recognition that while we have the legal right to develop the land, that we also respect native customary rights, which is why we did try and apply the principles of free, prior, and informed consent as soon as we arrived. Now, the challenges and learnings that we then had was where we really got those free, prior, and informed consent processes wrong to begin with, and those had to be adapted for the Liberian condition. Now, over the last couple of years, what we've also encountered is that the environmental requirements have become much more stringent. So we have now also made a commitment to identify and try and conserve high carbon stock forests in addition to high conservation value.
Andrew, perhaps I can turn to you and put the same point to you then. What have you learned from your experience in Liberia, and what in particular are you going to be doing in terms of the size of your eventual development?
Okay, first of all, I should make the point that the land hasn't been given to GVL. Under the concession agreement, we're entitled to negotiate up to 220,000 hectares of land in principle, but we've always accepted the point that despite what the concession agreement says about it being given to us free and unencumbered, we negotiate with every single community for every single hectare that we might develop. I think Mark has made some very good points there, that we've had to go through a very steep learning curve on this. I think John also alluded to the fact that it's a matter of scale. Some of the agreements we've reached maybe have been on too large a scale and haven't recognized the specific demands or requirements or needs of individual communities in the way that perhaps we should have done in the first place. And we're actually negotiating with communities on a regular basis and trying to reflect on those with local NGOs and also with organizations such as FBP and TFD to make sure that we can get that balance right in future. The problem here is you've got to get a balance on scale. And this is where we see that the smallholder program, the community oil farm, has an advantage, because we would then be working with individual communities where the traditional land rights have been established by that community, and we're working on undisputed land in a manner where we're going to be reaching agreements with either individual communities or collections of communities which consent to work together. So I think that's a key issue that we have to bear in mind on this. When we are working in those areas, I think the issue around capacity has also been mentioned. Both John and Marcus refer to the fact that you've got communities that are really, really keen on having some development in Liberia. Golden Brolin works in the remote southeast, and for several months of the year, access to those areas is extremely restricted. The road conditions are appalling, and trying to get goods and supplies either down there or back out again is really challenging. We have to work with that. We have to, in developing the ideas, not only for ourselves, but also for the community oil palm, for trying to develop this combined, blended conservation development process, we need to understand what capacity is available, both in infrastructure terms, but also in terms of the understanding of all the stakeholders, ourselves, our communities, the government of Liberia, advocacy and implementation NGOs and CSOs, but also potential aid agencies who are looking at putting in funding into community oil palm and helping them develop in those areas. But making sure that there is a proper understanding of the FPIC requirements, the fact that we need to engage those communities in a positive manner where they feel properly engaged, but also increasingly making sure that communities who do have conservable forest have to recognize that there is going to be a balance between conservation and development. And this is what we're talking about. When I introduced this and saying we'd like to be able to move the balance away from a predominantly GVL-led program to one where we're supporting community oil palm, but making sure in doing that that there is a very clear understanding of the potential benefits of that, but also the challenges that we're going to face in going forward on that, where the actual onus in terms of financing this is going to be transferred more to those communities, and making sure that they understand that very clearly, so that yes, the opportunity is being handed over to them, the control is being handed over to them more, but it also comes with obligations, and making sure that when we start that process that they're very, very clear on that.
Great, thank you very much indeed. Question come in on a really big area for smallholders, and the questioner says, and makes a good point, that smallholders need investment to raise their incomes. The questioner points that GVL is making some progress in raising investment with some outgrowers and their concessions. So I wondered, perhaps widening the question a little bit to Marcus, what do you think, from your perspective, makes for good investment in smallholder communities, and what is the role of, or what do you want to see companies doing to help develop investment further?
So I think what the communities are wanting is indeed assistance with both the infrastructure development and access to a certain amount of capital for their farms, seedlings, and so on. And those things are standard parts of smallholder development packages, so there's no big surprise about what's needed. It's really about the terms on which those are provided in exchange for surrendering the land that's the problem. And I just wanted to go back to what Andrew was saying, where he was saying what we need is a model that combines development and conservation at the same time, and that's certainly correct. But it's actually a bit more than that that we need, because we need development, conservation, and sustainable livelihoods for the local communities. So it's not just what is not going to be cut and what will be planted that we need to think about, but also where are the people going to make their living, maintain their culture, maintain the diversity of their crops, ensure they have food security, have access to areas of cultural importance, and so on. So that also needs to be part of the land use planning that should be done in the initial phases to make sure that people are really happy with the arrangement. I mean, it isn't impossible. These are very large areas that we're talking about. The population density is not that high. So there is enough land available for all three needs if it's done right. It's not that there won't be challenges and problems, of course, but I think there are ways through this if you can give people the security in their land and the secure livelihoods that they have to have.
Thanks very much, Marcus. John, perhaps turn this back to you now. What's your point you're going to make?
Yeah, well, it's just this conception of, well, this concessionary model, which people talk about being imposed. We have 220,000 hectares. I'm sort of trying to think, what I was thinking we might talk about is actually the development of smallholder oil palm. You know, this is a community oil palm. And that's where you have to actually talk to the community to find out what they want. It's not a matter of giving them control over their land. It's actually because it is their land. It's actually how you can strengthen their control over their land. And I think whether you're talking about a big concession or a smallholder, a company that has decided to do the right thing, if they decide to do the right thing in terms of communities, then the process of doing the right thing can help communities strengthen their land rights. So the mere act of agreeing with communities to help them document their territory as part of a process to identify lands that the company might want to develop, just the act of doing that is almost the first time for a lot of these communities ever had an opportunity to document their land in any sort of quasi-official way. And I think the idea, this is why I keep saying, if you have a good relationship with communities and you're mapping common interests, you know, there's a bit of a tension when you're talking to a lot of campaigning groups when you say to them that actually some companies, the work that they're doing with communities, you know, are strengthening community rights in a way that isn't being achieved through legal means in terms of the legislation, because the legislation in a lot of these countries is bad. Of course, there's lots of problems when companies do it badly, and when companies do it badly, they, you know, it's even worse than anything else. And so I feel when we're talking about the small development of a smallholder model for Africa, that, you know, we are learning now, because there isn't any good smallholder oil palm models that have been proven to work very well.
Good. A great point to finish on. And in fact, that leads us very well into our next question from our audience. It's really, again, back to Sime Darby and Golden Beryllium. Do you guys have an idea of the added costs that will be incurred in going the extra mile as you wish to with communities in smallholder farming areas? What is the competitive advantage in doing so? So what's the return on the extra investment? Mark, perhaps you could comment on that.
Maybe the best way for me to elaborate the cost of going the extra mile would be for me to talk through the opportunity cost. So when we first entered into Liberia, in the development plans, there was an expectation that we could actually develop roughly about 10,000 hectares per year. So that was the sort of rate of development that was built into the development plans based on the experiences that we'd had in Indonesia and Malaysia. Now, we've been in Liberia since 2009, and we've planted up roughly about 10,500 hectares of oil palm. 7,000 hectares of that it was actually a conversion from post-conflict cover. So really, what we've been able to develop in terms of new plantations is really only about 3,000 hectares. So if you compare that sort of rate of development to the original plans that we had, I think that gives you a certain indication of the opportunity cost of going the extra mile. Now, in saying that, though, we don't think that there's really any other way to do it. Again, for all the reasons that we've talked about over the last couple minutes, especially around respecting native customary rights and ensuring that we try and move forward in a way that that makes sense. Now, talking about this new model around trying to build in conservation, resilient livelihoods, as well as some form of cash crops through smallholder farming. Now, moving forward, the extra costs around that are going to be a little bit different. And so the idea here is that what we have to build is not just a model for smallholder farmers in Africa, but we've also got to try and create the right funding mechanisms that allows for these communities to develop in that way. And what I mean by that is that there's going to be funding that's going to be required for the actual development of the cash crops, whether that's oil palm or other kind of cash crops. But at the same time, there's going to be a certain amount of funding that needs to go through into ensuring that communities actually are able to intensify the agriculture they have and to ensure that livelihoods and their food needs are met over a period of time. At the same time, there's also going to be a certain amount of funding that goes through into trying to understand how to tie conservation through into these development options for communities. Now, what's going to be difficult is to expect a company to be the ones to actually fork up that kind of financial arrangements. What a company can actually do, though, is to think about how we change the business model. And what I mean by that is that, you know, instead of then thinking about trying to develop a whole concession up where we operate and manage the plantations in that area, the idea then is to try and say, okay, look, if we were to now move into a smallholder-based business model, where a company like Sandabi would invest in infrastructure, a company like Sandabi would invest in the more diffuse and smaller scale processing facilities that would need to be put in place to cater with a much more fragmented industry, and that Sandabi would actually invest in terms of ergonomic and support programs for the cash crops themselves. But what's really needed is some rethinking around how some of that funding and financing mechanisms can then be leveraged to actually invest through into community farms as well.
Mark, thank you very much indeed. Andrew, just turning to you then, how does Golden Verolium measure the competitive advantage from engaging properly with smallholder farmers in their communities?
Well, I think it's a little bit early within the process to be able to say there's a clear competitive advantage. We don't think the costs of community oil palm are going to be significantly different from those of the major farms in the long run. And the reason for this is because the communities that have indicated a strong interest in doing this have indicated that they would like to retain ownership of the organization, the cooperative or company that will own the development, but they want to be able to outsource a great deal of the development for the period of any time when they're taking the loan to be able to finance what they're doing. But I'd just like to add on one or two other things around land ownership and not just conservation and development, but also alternative or sustainable livelihoods. We make it clear to all our communities that we don't own the land. We only get access to use of the land for oil palm developments. There is a draft Land Rights Act in Liberia, and GVL have been asked to take part in an advisory group on community land self-identification, and we believe that we hope the Land Rights Act will go through, and that will clearly identify that ownership of the land will rest with communities. So even at the end of any period where oil palm may be grown, the land should revert to the community at the end, and it's very clear under that law that ownership of the land does not change once oil palm starts being developed. But that then means we can work in a much more constructive manner with the communities. We can work at a smaller scale with community oil farms, so we think we can start from 250 hectares upwards rather than working on 1,000, 2,000 hectares, which is what we typically do when we're working on our own farms. And the arrangements that we're talking about, we've alluded to, as Mark from the Sandabi point of view, around these conservation and production agreements would involve.
Andrew, we've lost you slightly. Okay, we'll come back to you in a second, Andrew. I'd like to move move things along a little bit. We are getting close to the end of the hour. I'd like to think about, and it's a question from our audience, how the move to taking a landscape approach is improving the way that companies are engaging with the smallholder challenges. Perhaps John from TFT, you can come in on that, how the change to the landscape approach is improving matters. John.
Well, the principle behind the landscape approach is you're bringing all these other stakeholders into the debate about conservation planning, the landscape planning, so what bits are going to be, protected and what parts are going to be developed. And I think it's great. My worry is actually looking at landscape level projects going back over many decades in Africa is that they've been great ideas from coming down from on high, being imposed upon local people. And local people are generally completely neglected in the discussion. They're not involved in the landscape planning, which is odd, considering that they are the main landholders. So for me, I think it's a great approach, but only if it's done well. And it's exactly the same way what I'm saying about companies engaging well. But just to jump back on what Mark was saying about the opportunity costs, I think both GBL and Sime Darby will be able to make another calculation on opportunity costs based around the cost of the conflict that they've experienced. And if they had done the right thing from the beginning and actually invested in the systems properly, then I think a lot of that could have been avoided just simply by understanding your constituency.
Great. Thank you very much. Now, in the interest of time, I'd like to put one final question to everybody. So, Marcus, I'll bring you in a second. The final question is one that's actually come up several times from our audience, and it really is around to the extent that the experiences in Liberia are similar to those that are elsewhere in Africa. So, Marcus, in summary then, what do you think are, how far do you see the experiences in Liberia being reflected elsewhere in Africa?
I think it's very encouraging to hear everybody in this panel basically agreeing on what needs to be happening in the future. We seem to have convergence on the fact that legal reform is necessary. We're hoping to get that in Liberia, and those same kind of reforms will be needed in the other countries to provide the basis for smallholder security so they can engage in the sector with confidence. I think it's also worth recalling that smallholder models aren't new. There's a lot of success. 90% of rubber is produced by smallholders, not by large plantations. In Indonesia, in Thailand, with palm oil, 70% of the production comes from smallholders. Why is it possible in Thailand? Because they have a good legal regime which gives rights to farmers. And so it is possible in the palm oil sector, and many other crops have gone that way. Even in bananas, which used to be a huge plantation industry, they're moving towards more and more smallholders. So, this is the way to go. Land security, bringing in the environment and these landscape approaches, but rooting them in the communities need for sustainable livelihoods.
Thanks very much, Marcus. Andrew, I see you back on the line. Perhaps you can give us your perspective on how you think the experiences in Liberia will reflect development elsewhere in Africa.
Okay, well, first of all, I should point out that GVL is a Liberia company. We don't operate elsewhere in Africa, but we've been very heavily involved in TFA 2020, which is looking to establish principles for conservation programs throughout Africa, and Liberia's put in place a set of principles which reflect a lot of the points that have been made today. Conservation has to go hand in hand with community land rights and with development, and we understand that the principles that have been applied in Liberia and developed in Liberia have actually been taken around to other countries in certainly Western Africa, and suggested as a good model for other countries to consider developing similar principles themselves. So in terms of the debate that's now taking place in Liberia, I would say that there is now an openness of debate which is giving opportunities for all parties to make their points, and for us then to have a sensible debate about converging ideas, which will then, I hope, move into much more practical application. Again, we've talked about the production protection arrangements through much of this, and I think part of that has been driven very, very firmly by the learning that we've had in the last few years in Liberia.
Great. No, thank you very much indeed. Mark, turning to you, from your perspective, what are the things that have been learned in Liberia that could be relevant elsewhere?
So, just want to make the same point that Andrew did, which is that Liberia is the only African country in which Sandabi has any operations or experience in. But I think one of the key things to extrapolate out from our experiences is that there's no cookie cutter process that can be put in place, and that really moving into any territory or looking at any other country, the key thing is trying to understand how it is that the principles you're trying to implement fits within that cultural and socioeconomic context. And just drawing on points that both Marcus and John have made, that the only way to do that is really to ensure that the engagement that you conduct is really robust, and that you engage as much as possible, because only by engaging can you then understand how you need to adapt things for that particular cultural and socioeconomic landscape.
Thank you very much, Mark. John, turning to you, the final word, from TFT's perspective, what are you learning, what are you taking from Liberia and extrapolating and using elsewhere?
Well, I think what we've learned in Liberia is the problem with trying to import models from abroad. So it's this, what Mark is saying, it's this concept among smallholder strategies. It's a place-based strategy. You've got to look at the history of places. You've got to look at what the communities are like, their production systems, and the political system at play. And rather than colluding with the systems which are oppressing smallholders, which some companies have done in the past, hiding behind that legality, it's actually engaging those communities directly, where you create that individual model for those places. And that's what I see Liberia doing, is driving the development of these new models, which I think if we can get it right, then I think there's a lot of potential to have this working in other places. If we get it wrong, then we'll learn something.
Thank you very much indeed. Well, it's a good place to close. I'm going to have to stop this discussion now as we have run out of time. I'd like to thank the panel very much indeed for their time and insight, and to the audience, apologies for the technical gremlins we've had, and thank you for being with us over the past hour. Once again, if you'd like to continue the debate on smallholder farmers, then please do join us in London next month. We'll send you a recording of this webinar so you can listen again at your leisure and share with your colleagues. We always welcome feedback, so please don't hesitate to contact any of us at Innovation Forum with any follow-up questions and comments. But for now, I hope you found the past hour interesting, and thank you very much for listening.